Welcome to Surviving Society Presents, the Black Health and Humanities Network podcast. These episodes focus on the politics of black health in modern society.
Hello all. So today is the last episode in our podcast series with Surviving Society. I'm Kalecia Nucha. I'm part of the Black Health and Humanities Network. And today I'm going to be having a conversation with Chantel and Alenan Mishi.
Thank you so much for introducing us, Kalecia. Brilliant to be here. And hello, Lennon.
Hey, how are you?
Maybe you can start by telling us a bit about what your research is about, where you position yourself.
At the moment, I'm based at the Petrovas Museum at the University of Oxford, and my work is coming out of the exploration of the intersections of colonial collections and museum and contemporary art. I'm interested particularly in the histories of museumization as what I'm calling infrastructures of containment, and how museums have functioned in a sense to hold hostage not just material culture and belongings from different parts of Africa and the world, but also holding in place the histories of violence and extraction and the forgetting that happens when material is taken out of context. So my work basically comes out of my background in anthropology, and is interdisciplinary.
So Lennon, is that kind of looking at how museums collect or extract objects and art and then contain them within their own infrastructure?
Precisely. I'm keen to draw parallels between the museum, for instance, in a settler colonial context, and how it functions to subsidize a very specific logic of colonial extraction, where the museum exists alongside the camp and the reserve and the border. And then the ethnographic project aligned to certain moments in colonial history unfortunately also reproduces some of the punitive orientations that generally characterize colonial and carceral regimes.
So it's kind of like how art is presented alongside of settler colonialism, oppression and marginalisation. So how those things become understood at the same time, would you say? So we're getting quite abstract here, listeners, but like I'm trying to sort of get to some of the nitty-gritty of it. But it's really amazing because I've not thought about museums in this way before. It's like, it's kind of like the entertainment piece of colonialism, isn't it?
I'm exactly trying to, you know, complement a lot of the work that has been taking place in the museum sector, where a lot of my colleagues have been trying to uncover some of the colonial histories that accompany material that enters museums either as ethnographic or as part of the natural history collections, and in general, how contemporary artistic practice can help us, you know, shed more light, bring more complexity, but also rethink, you know, the implications of how this material is held in museum collections. So in effect then, it tries to subvert the way that the histories of violence and extraction that are held in museums did become forms of leisure and entertainment for many populations across Europe and the Americas. But what is leisure and entertainment here is exactly the holding in place of these histories of colonial violence and extraction.
So it's that it can, but it can also, what I'm also hearing in what you're saying, Lennon, is that the museum can also be a place of critique. It can also be a place of accountability. It can also be a site of resistance.
Yes, I'm drawn to some of the work on abolition, you know, from Ruth Wilson Gilmore to Angela Davis, Marion Kaba, which suggests that, you know, we must, in order to be able to bring into being this new condition, this new state of at least some form of collapse of the structures of oppression and marginality, to be able to imagine what that new thing might look like. So the museum, as it has existed historically, has not necessarily been a neutral space, I say this often. And part of the work is to try and explore how generative museums of different kinds can be. I mean, for instance, I you know, some of the work I've been doing looks at what community-led practice in the museum might look like. So how do we invite different people of the African diaspora in the UK, for instance, to come and work with us in rethinking some of this colonial collection so that it's not just static material held in place, but as you say, it's a productive conversation.
How did you come to this research topic? How did you find your way into this kind of relationship with an institution like a museum? Kind of maybe tell us more about how you got to this point.
I've always been interested, I guess, in a sense, in thinking about where I come from, you know, in Zimbabwe, where I was born, and how, you know, the conversation around colonialism often tends towards some sort of closure, to say the colonial moment, you know, ends with this idea of African independence and decolonization. But I, of course, recognized the enduring elements of this coloniality that exist outside the specific historical moment that inaugurates what we understand as the colonial. So this has been present in my work, from my PhD work, so as when I was in London, to my postdoctoral work at the moment. So the museum here is one site for the production of that specific kind of coloniality. And I enter it, you know, as a person who is invested not in reproducing those colonial logics, but in gesturing towards something else.
What you're saying resonated with me in the terms of kind of breaking some of that kind of temporal, durational, maybe kind of trying to interrupt or intervene in some of the kind of, yeah, the kind of enduring sense of a particular kind of colonial kind of orientation, legacy, domination even.
Exactly.
I mean, how do we as academics, and I don't want to, I mean, I'm going to speak for the three of us now, but how do we as academics of African descent working in these institutions that have previously extracted, colonized, theft, violence, how do we kind of grapple with doing this work at speaking back to that history whilst also playing a part in reproducing some of those things as well?
I think, thank you so much for that, Chantal. I mean, it's a very difficult question. And I try to think of my work as being a very tiny fragment of a much larger history and conversation. And if I can build relationships that, you know, foster a sense that another sort of way of inhabiting these spaces and the planet is possible, then I would have at least made, you know, in a very small way, some sort of contribution to this conversation. I think the being implicated in the structures and the history of the colonial, it exists whether you are in a university or not. I struggle a lot with imagining what space is innocent, you know, whether it's the university or it's the bank, you know, or it's the NGO doing development work.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all have to contend with how we are implicated in different ways. I mean, in the ways Stuart Hall says, you know, the I is always enunciated. You know, we speak and write from a position, you know. This position, we have to enunciate it based on our experiences. So I guess, you know, it's important to not be burdened with this demand that as people of African descent in these different institutions, we're not messiahs, you know, to sort of bring sort of the saving of anything. But we are, in a sense, in conversation together and trying to build towards something different.
Brilliant answer.
Why is this topic so kind of important for wider audiences outside of academia, would you say?
The work I do, you know, even if it's research, is a critical part of recognizing what we often reference as unfinished past. As part of a sort of the production of a common sense understanding of things like empire in the everyday. I think one of the most dominant strands of thinking around museums is what Chantel was just pointing out, you know, that they're places of entertainment, you know, and places of leisure. So we take, for instance, the presence of human remains in museums, and we say, what does it mean to be entertained by the ancestors of other people on display? Now, if we recognize the sort of liberal values that we say of human rights, dignity, rights to cultural property, then we also have to share with our publics that the work in the museum is important in the production of that common sense, that it's not just for researchers, but it's for us to sort of rethink how we share spaces, how we inhabit communities together. I think part of my interest in the museum as well is how the museum can be a site for continuing to share the complexity of the cultures that have material and belongings that are held in this museum. So for instance, we often talk about, you know, the idea of Africa in the sort of Western imagination, you know, and the ethnographic museum and other museums have been a crucial part of re-inscribing those notions of what this Africa is in the popular imagination. Now, if the museum can play a small part in sharing a much more complex narrative, that these cultures are not just in a past that they were thrown into by enslavement and colonialism, but that they continue to be present, rich, dynamic, evolving, and worthy of a much more appreciative, rather than just a sort of sensational, scopophilic gaze, you know, then I think, at least in part, I think it's about inviting communities to think together how we can share space, knowledge, history, differently.
Thank you so much for that then. And that's such a beautiful description of the museum. It really is. And like, to be able to speak about it in that way, given that it's such a contentious space, I think is really powerful for us. And I guess on that note, it'd be really good to talk a bit about some of the challenges for you personally, as an academic, as an individual, as an I.
You know, I come into the museum, you know, having spent most of my life, adult life, in academic institutions, and recognizing that, you know, academic institutions, like many organizations, are given to bosses, you know, to bureaucracy, to this idea of rules and norms, yes, that govern our institutions function. And that when you enter a space that is those sort of norms and traditions, you know, this is how things work, or this is how things have always worked. Even if you're not coming into direct confrontation with individuals per se, the infrastructure is a way of making you encounter its bureaucracy as a thing in itself, as a process. And so it's been fascinating for me to sort of recognize how conversations around restitution, for instance, and repair are governed by a particular attention to law, to regulation, to process, not because these are not important, but it's fascinating to try and consider where bureaucracy and rules and norms are part of cultivating relationships and meaningful, as they say, due process, or they're part of obstructing, slowing down, and technologies actually of reinscribing sort of marginalization and domination. I think you would, of course, recognize this, you know, with many black and minoritized, you know, researchers, that the grammars sometimes of sort of navigating institutional space are not always available to you in the moment that you enter sort of different institutional spaces, and you have to learn these grammars, you know, as you go, you know, sort of you're in the deep end and you're also trying to sort of navigate all the other institutional mechanisms. I do think that, you know, there's also the danger that when you enter an institution, you become sort of the face of something, and you might be seen as being representational in that sense. Whereas you, again, you know, going back to the short opposition, you're enunciating something as an I, but that I is related to a much larger historical presence and collective. So if trying to then navigate how you're positioned as you and how you're positioned as representing something within an institutional space can be quite challenging. Well, I guess, I mean, I must say that, you know, one of the challenges is actually just, you know, learning your limits and your boundaries.
Yeah.
You know, you being in a space where there's so much going on, and, you know, it might feel like you can't say no, or you can't refuse things. So it's been, you know, so learning sort of boundaries and limits has been really important too.
That really resonates, I'm sure, for many people kind of moving through their careers at different stages. Am I right in thinking, just to ask a question, am I right in thinking some of this work that you, this research that you've been describing, is part of a kind of a wider research project? Is it called Reconnecting Objects? And I'm just kind of briefly, having looked at the project, which looks really excellent, I was really interested by this idea of kind of alternative ways of kind of object handling, alternative forms of thinking about kind of custody. And I was connecting that with the question that came to mind, which was, where can hope be found in your research? Is there another side to this in which, yeah, that something does open up and become possible?
Yes. I think this work has been taking place for a while, you know, in different parts of the world. And different communities have been, in conversation with people in museums, not just in trying to get material returned to those communities, but as you say, different forms of labeling. What do we call a thing, an object, a sacred object? What do we call ancestors who are held in these legacy institutions? There has been a lot of work in rethinking how this material is displayed. You know, who can touch it? When can it be brought up? Should it be even displayed at all? I do think that, you know, it's always useful to think extra institutionally, that, you know, the hope is not necessarily something that is to be within the infrastructure of the museum itself. But I think the hope is in the kinds of relationships that are being built beyond the infrastructure of the museum. So that if different museums looked nothing like they look today, the possibilities that inherit within them wouldn't end because the infrastructure is shifted. But actually, you build on those relationships into the future. I am very, very heartened by our colleagues in these different countries, in Cameroon, South Africa, in Senegal, in Berlin. You know, we have colleagues in Ghana, in Uganda, in Kenya. They're so many communities and individuals who are putting in a lot of themselves into this work. And I think that sort of, I always, you know, go back to Catherine McKittrick's sort of, you know, idea of Black livingness and sort of sharing in sort of Black histories and forms of sharing and collective thinking. So I think there's a lot of hope. I mean, this, I must say that, you know, it's always very difficult to articulate what, you know, this hope is, you know, outside that sort of Obama-esque hope, yeah. Like, you know, that sort of sort of very specific political structure of hope. But, you know, I guess...
What do you think embodied hope is, Lennon?
Ah, yes. I think, I mean, in my work, I mean, hope has been embedded in very tiny traces and fragments, you know, in people who sort of open up these little cracks and crevices for you to get some light and feel like these different spaces and institutions are livable and survivable. It's been in really specific kinds of generous work, very kind work. And care, not as this flippant sort of, you know, we throw about care, say, oh, you know, doing the care work, but substantive acts of care by people who work in these different institutions. I think hope is embodied in practices and gestures towards building a different world, you know. What people do in effort to say other worlds are possible, you know, other worlds have existed and continue to exist, and we can build outside the frame of a sort of extractive and violent history.
That was such a great answer. I mean, like, hearing that, Lennon, that kind of instruction about gestures, practices, embodiments of care and hope and love. One thing that I think I've been thinking a lot about in my own practice as a podcaster, as an academic, but also how you kind of document these stories, is how I can only do this work and be loving and caring in this work if I'm loving and caring of myself. And like, it's been really crazy for me to actually like recognize how that is such an important part of our political practice as well. It's the essential component. Like, if I'm not well, then I can't be loving.
Yeah,
precisely.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, sorry, slightly self-indulgent there, but that's what you made me think when you were talking then. And like, it's so much about the connection between the self and the collective.
Precisely. I mean, I come from a cosmology where the self is indivisible from the generation of the collective. So
say more. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, we say, you know, in Shona we say munu, you know, munu nevanu. I mean, it's very similar to what has been called ubuntu. But the idea really is that, you know, your personhood and your sense of being in the world is only in relation.
Mm.
And so we are relational beings, and we make sense of how we inhabit the planet and the universe based on those relations. But so we are well in relation, you know, and we allow others to be well in relation. Well, that's why I think of practices of care, at least that they're relational. You care for yourself, and it enables you to care for others, and vice versa, you know. So I don't think of it as self-indulgence at all. I think it's a necessary part of how we build these relations. Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you, Lennon.
I'm a nice slow thinker. So yeah, this has been a lot to digest, but very welcome and very enriching. So thank you, Lennon, for taking this time to speak with the both of us. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Lennon.
It's a privilege to be in conversation with you. I appreciate the existence of spaces like this, where these sort of conversations can continue. And of course, you must continue to take care of yourself and others, so we keep the spaces alive.
Thank you so much. And that's a wrap, listeners. Thank you for joining us for the Black Health and Humanities Network podcast of Surviving Society. You can check out the full series on our website at Surviving Society.
Thank you for listening to Surviving Society.
To support our work, you can rate,
review and subscribe. To host or produce a series of Surviving Society,
get in touch with us via Twitter or Instagram.